As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. So I thought it would be fun this week to go through some of our favorite pieces of product advice that we've received lately.
Okay. Kind of like a best of, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. We've been doing this for over 6 years. We've had almost 400 episodes. And so we've had many perspectives on the show. And I wanted to highlight some of the pieces of advice that, you know, I keep coming back to in my personal work.
All right. I feel like Jerry Seinfeld writing that last episode.
What?
You know, the one where they witness a mugging, but they don't actually do anything about it, so they get arrested. Then in the courtroom, they have witnesses take the stand to talk about the ways that they had wronged them over the years.
Yeah, just like that.
All right, never mind. We should just get right into it, I guess.
Welcome to Rocketship.fm.
Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective.
We are your hosts, Michael Sacca.
And I'm Mike Belsito.
All right, so one of the most important lessons that I've taken with me over the years comes from Allison Goh.
Ah, okay. I remember the interview with Allison. You recorded that right after her talk at Industry, I think it was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, we were talking about her time at Amazon, a company that does everything at scale, and a major blind spot that she had when releasing a big update to Audible.
So we wanted to be modern, right? Yeah. We wanted to update the app so it matched that look and feel. Part of the thinking was like, you know, if you have an old, crusty looking app, people won't want to use it, like, right. Won't trust it even. And actually, like, you know, What's really interesting is if you want to recruit people to work on your product, like engineers, like they're going to look at this thing. It has like all the drop shadows or whatever. Yeah. And they're like, what is this thing? Like, I don't want to work on this. So there's a little bit of that. And so we went through this exercise of modernizing the app, right? Or modernizing the look and feel. We didn't really change that much of it, like the functionality.
Seems innocent enough.
Completely. I've been guilty of more than a few indulgent UI redesigns, right? But this was a major update for Apple, and Audible being an incredibly popular app, Amazon didn't want it to be seen as falling behind.
So how bad of a mistake could it have been then?
The app was like white and had like a gray kind of gradient to it, which was like super like pre iOS 7 or whatever version.
Okay.
This change happened on. But it was like white and gray. So what we did was like, okay, we're going to do like a white background and no more gradients. And it's going to be like white and like very clean looking, very modern. We launched it and we made it. It's like, we were like, that's so beautiful. People are going to love it. And turns out when you have like a white app, that's like really, really, really awful at night.
Okay. All right.
Right. So you have to think about some of the popular use cases of Audible. Right.
And turns out people use Audible at night a lot, you know, and not only that, they, you know, use it before they go to bed. But the thing that really killed me was one part of our like customer base or audience are like people who like long haul truckers.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
Yep.
A lot of long-haul truckers in Texas. And they end up driving through the night, and they have their Audible app, and then it's like a beacon, like screaming at them from their mount, and it's like literally dangerous. It's dangerous for them because it's so bright.
Wow. Yeah.
And they dim it to the very lowest level, but it still doesn't help. It's too bright.
Okay.
And so these were just use cases that, you know, me as a city dweller who uses it on the subway.
Yeah, I would not have seen that coming either.
Right? And if they were all living in New York City, I doubt anyone on the team drove much, let alone overnight, all night on pitch dark streets.
So this is like my universe of how I use Audible and use audiobooks. And so like none of us picked up on this use case, right? And so no one spoke up and was like, hey, there's these people who might use it in this way. And so we put out this product, this change, not thinking about all these people. So I think this comes back, seems like I'm a huge proponent of user research, but I really am, right? Because if we had a much stronger sense of who the user was and really understood their use cases fully, I feel like we could have caught this much earlier.
So how did they end up fixing it?
And what we ended up doing, like once we we made a night mode as a fix.
Yeah.
And so to test night mode, we actually like blocked out like rooms and made them like pitch black to like test if they were too bright. It's really funny. But it was like, you know, like that was so avoidable if we really truly understood the various use cases of Audible. And that was on me, you know, not really digging into that and just having a fairly myopic view of who our user is.
Right.
And that, like, yeah, I know about our truckers. I know that that's a core audience for us. But then, like, I didn't really understand it at the depth where I'm like, but long haul, and they drive it. No, I don't have a car. This is the case for, like, diversity. It's the case for having a team that, like, can speak up and say, hey, like, I used this at night. It was really bright. Like, maybe you should consider that. And so, like, building that culture and, like, really pushing people to speak up is also important. So, like, understanding your user. And many of those people are going to be working with you, which is awesome. Being able to hear those voices, but as well as the voices out there that maybe you don't have a lot of visibility in on your day-to-day.
Got to diversify your team to cover those blind spots.
That's right. Even the best of us can be guilty of overlooking kind of critical user needs because their use cases, they're just different than ours.
Yeah, it kind of like that time where Kramer's ex-girlfriend was getting mad about Jerry.
Mike, let's stay on track here.
Fine. But it is the puffy shirt episode. I'm just saying.
All right. Let's talk about recruitment. How about that?
Okay. Let's talk about recruitment. Sebastian Spear kind of comes to mind. I mean, he's now a design lead at Instagram, but before he was the global design director on Nike sneakers.
I think Nike gets about 70,000 applicants a year or something. So it's like really hard to kind of like sort through all those applicants, even on the design side. So they really use the kind of networks of the design teams at Nike. So like, I would say the best place and kind of like the strategy that we use here on my team is kind of like word of mouth, try to get in touch with somebody on one of the teams and see what the openings are through them. We kind of find almost all of our best talent through like a word of mouth strategy. And as soon as someone on my team finds someone, they'll either refer them to me or then we kind of put
them. So Sebastian, for instance, gets these designs in his hiring pipeline. What's he looking for?
At least on a team like ours, in my opinion, most product teams are, you know, like exceptionally collaborative. So teamwork and a lack of ego is like very, very important. That's almost one of the first things we try to identify. As a product designer, you're going to be wearing like several different hats. You're going to be stepping outside your comfort zone a lot.
I love that. Look for a lack of ego because that can really become a problem down the line and recruit from within your network.
Even with thousands and thousands of applicants, their best hires tend to come from within the network of people working at Nike.
And hopefully it's a diverse network. Otherwise, it's worth working on diversifying your pipeline of candidates so you don't run into the same issues that Allison Goh did at Audible. But we should stop here for a minute for a word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Let's jump over to some product philosophy. Jeetu Patel, who's the Chief Product Officer and Chief Strategy Officer at Box, talked with us about the approach that they take when deciding when to build a feature.
Yeah, we actually have this philosophy that we use, which is this notion of, 10Xing the capability for the market. And the thinking over there is, if you build something that is not at least 10 times better than what the existing solution is, chances of you being able to motivate a customer or a user to move over to you is pretty small. You know, so 20% improvement on some way of doing it, the inertia is so strong that you just won't be able to motivate people from moving over to you. So how do you then think about innovation at a 10x? The nice part about this 10x rule is it makes it very easy for what problems to focus on and which problems not to focus on. Because let's say you found a really big problem, but the solve that you have is only 20% better than what might currently be available in the market. Don't bother with trying to solve the problem. You know, it's not going to have the level of traction and potency as it would if you were going out and doing something that was 10x.
So a product or feature should be 10 times better than what's currently available. That's an awesome way to think about where to put your team's efforts in.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's hear from one of our favorite guests and someone who just keynoted Industry 2019.
Are you talking about Common?
Ugh. Well, I wish. No, we haven't had him on.
I know. I think you're talking about Bob Mesta.
I am. Yes. Let's talk about one of his favorite things.
It's got to be jobs to be done, right?
Well, close, right? How about anxieties?
Okay. Yes. This is his replacement for personas. Instead of focusing on a made-up persona of a customer, you focus on what anxieties would push or pull someone to a product.
The notion here is this, is that if I can understand what caused you to buy my condo, so I would actually, I only interview people who have already made the progress. So somebody who, I don't want to interview somebody who wants to buy a house. I actually interview people who have already bought the house. Because in that process of doing so, they actually have all these forces that push them and pull them, but they also had anxieties along the way. They also had habits that they had to overcome. And what happens is when they're in the midst of it, they actually don't, none of those are as explicit, or they're, if you will, in the subconscious. But afterwards, you can actually pull them back and say like, yeah, this and this happened. And I'm like, well, why would you do that? And you just dig and you dig and you start to realize like, well, I was really worried about something.
So how do we find out what those anxieties are?
I'm actually just trying to get the truth. But what you realize is we start to actually, so we never talk to people who want to do something. We talk to people who have actually tried and either failed or made it, but they're past the decision point. They've made some kind of commitment to do something. Because if I interview people who just want to buy a house and they're like, I'm in the market and I'm looking, what happens is you get, I want 5 bedrooms, I want 3.5 baths, I want granite countertops, I want, and because there's no money involved. But the reality is when they purchase, there is no purchase that is ideal. Every purchase has a trade-off in it. And ultimately, I'm trying to use trade-offs to understand the hierarchy of what's important to them.
So Bob had a great story to illustrate this about a friend who bought an $80,000 car.
That's an $80,000 car, absolutely gorgeous. Drives up, like, wow, this thing is beautiful. He goes, yeah, it's great. It's gray. I'm like, wait, and it's his face. I'm like, what? He goes like, well, you know, I wanted white. I'm like, but you just bought an $80,000 car and it's not the color you want? He goes, yeah, I had to wait 2 more weeks.
2 weeks? That's it? He'd probably have the car for 5 to 10 years.
Yep, it's pretty crazy.
Well, it couldn't have been that important then. Like at some point, it's like if you could have waited 2 weeks, you could rent a car for that. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, and it's one of those things where it's like you start to realize like we make trade-offs, and as much as it says, God, I really want white, and I would say white all the time, the reality is that he wanted the car and he wanted to have, you know, there's a whole bunch of other things that were at play. And despite the fact of what he said he wanted, he was able, willing to trade off. And so part of it is the value code of how people are, how these things are helping them make progress, that value code is embedded in all the trade-offs they make.
Always fascinating. This is one of the concepts that first helped draw me to the jobs to be done framework.
All right, nice. Well, let's move on from that and anxieties to storytelling. When you actually talked in the past to Michael Jarman, who at one point wrote for Beavis and Butthead, and if I remember, in that conversation, you said you couldn't remember the story of Jack and the Beanstalk.
Honestly,
seriously,
I couldn't. Just roll the clip.
Hero, obstacle, goal.
Interesting.
It's the struggle of a hero fighting an obstacle to achieve a goal. And that's it.
Okay.
And it's not 2 goals. It's not 3 obstacles. It's 1, 1, and 1. And that's it. So I'm going to give you an example, just for everyone, you know, an example that everyone's familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yep.
So who's the hero?
Jack.
Good. Got it right. The hero is used to the, he's got his name in the title. So what is his goal?
It's.
All right. Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
All right. So let's talk a bit about working together as a team.
Yeah, one of the hardest parts of being a product manager is finding the balance between pushing the team forward and micromanaging.
Right? No one really reports to you, but you still got to lead the team.
Mm-hmm. And when we talked with Natalie Nagel, the CEO of WildBit, she laid out some boundaries and expectations that she sets for her team.
Sure. So we have a rule, one of our kind of main values and our rules in our company is we only work 40 hours a week. So that means that, you know, Chris and I only work 40 hours, and all those 40 hours have to be really focused on the work at hand. And that's the only way that kind of works. And so what we've been trying to do is making sure that everybody is given those 40 hours as their own personal productivity time, and to look at how we work together as a way of borrowing each other's time. So instead of taking for granted working together and asking somebody a question and collaborating, we really try to focus and say, like, anytime I bother somebody, I'm taking time away from them. So how do I really minimize that or be really thoughtful about the way in which we work together and collaborate as a team?
I like how they set the framework for the whole team to work within. When you think about using someone's time in that way, it does give you pause.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's continue on the topic of management. Let's talk about emotional labor.
Ah, this must be Seth Godin.
That's right. He's like our John Lovitz.
Huh?
You know, he guest starred on Seinfeld that one time, the cancer episode.
Yeah, I'm not following.
Because he's famous. Just play the clip.
Okay.
Never mind.
I think the lesson has to do with emotional labor. Emotional labor is what most of us do for a living now. We don't dig a ditch. We don't carry weights around. We work with feelings. And if we're getting paid, it's probably because we're doing something we don't feel like doing on any given day. That it takes emotional labor for an oncologist to look someone in the eye and talk to them about their impending doom. It takes emotional labor for a flight attendant to smile when she doesn't feel like smiling. Mm. It takes emotional labor to engage with a customer and help her understand that she could achieve more if she just dug in.
Yeah.
And so part of my quest has been to understand, where do we get the reserves to do this emotional labor?
So this next one was a special one for me.
Okay. How so?
So this was our 8th episode, and we were talking with Adi Paner, and it felt like we had really captured something special at this moment.
Okay. Go on a bit more on this one.
Yeah. So we were talking about the topic of burnout, which, you know, we're all at risk hitting, but it's also something that we don't talk about a lot. And it felt like Adi was just coming out of it, or maybe even still in it. And so he gave us this really honest depiction of what it was like for him to experience burnout.
I mean, so for 4 years, I mean, Withheim's about a 7-year journey for me. And my wife and I, you know, we've been together for about 4.5 years now. And just taking the last 4.5 years, I mean, it sounds absolutely ridiculous saying this out loud, and I'm not part of this, but, you know, within that 4.5 years, I probably spent more time with Withheim's than I did with my wife. I knew at one stage that would need to change. So, you know, when I pressed pause on Polybeta, for the first couple of weeks, I literally did nothing. I would sit in front of my computer, I would click around, I would open tabs, I'd close tabs, and I literally did nothing. I didn't necessarily sleep late or any, I just did nothing. I didn't necessarily meet friends, I just did nothing. And then slowly after that, I started, you know, going to a different extreme, which was I'd go out often. I'd do loads of things with my son, loads of things with my wife. And it wasn't until about 2 months into at rest where, you know, I actually felt, you know, that I can move to, you know, something that resembles balance again.
So this next one, when you first included it, I was skeptical that it even related to product management.
Yeah, no, I could see that. But as a PM, and to be a really great PM, you have to understand the goals of the business, right? And so when Jason Cohen of WP Engine broke down kind of the goal of raising money, it was another light bulb moment for me.
And how does it change decisions for a product manager?
Right. So depending on the goals of the company, it changes what your North Star is, or your KPI, or how you set your OKR. If you're bootstrapped, it's margins, right? Margins and profit. If you're raising capital.
Yeah, the goal is not to raise an A round so that you can become profitable. The goal is to raise an A round so that you can hit milestones so that you can raise your B round. Like, once you start into the institutional money, goal isn't profit. The goal is growth. Mm-hmm. The goal is to own the market. The goal is to become as much of a monopoly as you can within the law. That's the goal.
And
maximum shareholder value.
And what would you say towards
fiduciary duty to do that? So profitability is the last thing you want, because profitability indicates that you're out of ideas for how to grow or invest or de-risk the business. Because if you had ideas of how to do those things, that's what you should be doing with that money. So it means you're out of ideas for how to spend that money against the company. And until, of course, you're very, very large and reaping that. Although even today, you can see that in, say, Amazon or Salesforce, that is still, running at razor thin cash flows because they keep reinvesting into the business to grow it, and successfully so. So no, that's not the goal, and there's no institutional investor who wants that to be the goal. Now, on the other hand, like, you don't want a completely broken business model. So of course there's going to be, and this depends on the business, what kinds of metrics you're looking at, but there's going to be metrics and ratios and things that are the goal. And some of them might be financial. And I do like a business, and we did this at WP Engine, I do like a business that that tries to close the gap on profitability. That is, the goal isn't to become profitable, but you should be seeing some kinds of approaching profitability, or at least profitable when you ignore certain kinds of expenses that you're intentionally overburning on, and seeing that the rest of the expenses is getting more and more profitable. Like, those kinds of things make a ton of sense, because that's showing the business is coming together and the business model is working as expected. No, you don't raise an A round with the goal of with the outcome of that being profitability. Not with an institute. You do that with angels, maybe, who are unsophisticated, but not with real investors.
Well, this was fun. I mean, it's kind of, crazy that we've done nearly 400 episodes. So I do think it's good every now and then to kind of go back into the archive and pull out the best of the best.
Yeah, no, these are, some of the things that I keep coming back to in my day-to-day work. And I really felt like, hey, maybe there's value in pulling them out one more time for people, just for that little reminder.
Yeah, and I don't think we have to wait to another 400 episodes to do it again. I think this would be good if we kept doing this every so often.
Yeah, maybe we'll do it next week. But no, just kidding. Thank you so much for listening to Rocketship.fm. It's your support that keeps the show going. Rocketship.fm is now part of the Podglomerate Network. If you want to learn more about the other shows on the Podglomerate Network, go to thepodglomerate.com.
Rocketship.fm is produced in partnership with Product Collective, a community for product people. If you go to productcollective.com, you could check out live video interviews, sign up for our newsletter, be a part of our Slack group with over 6,000 product people. Just check it out at productcollective.com.